The views and discussion expressed on this program do not necessarily represent those of the hosts of the program, WMKV, Maple Knoll Communities, WLHS, the Lakota Local School District, or staff and management. The information and advice presented are educational in nature and not intended to be taken as specific legal, accounting, or other professional advice. Always consult with your own legal, accounting, or other professional before making any investment. Welcome to Real Life Real Estate Investing, a show to help you gain financial freedom by investing in real estate. Brought to you by the Real Estate Investors Association of Cincinnati and the Ohio Real Estate Investors Association. You're listening to Real Life Real Estate Investing on WMKV, WLHS, and the Maple Knoll Radio Network. And now your host, Vina Jones Cox.
All right. Well, I am not Vina Jones Cox, but this is Real Life Real Estate Investing. My name is Scott Ellsworth. I'll be your guest host tonight. Vina is traveling the world. She is over in, I think, Eastern Europe and about ready to get on a boat. So she has a well-deserved vacation ahead of her. So tonight we have got a great session. We're going to talk about 1031 exchanges. If you don't know what those are, we'll explain them, but they are an awesome tax strategy to build your wealth. You can just make a massive headway into your building wealth. So tonight, just want to let you know this. So questions, 877-772-9658 or email vinaradio@gmail.com. My guest is Teresa Noer, and she is with Equity 1031 Exchange. Teresa, how are you?
I am doing well, Scott. How are you?
I'm good. It's always a good day when we're breathing and we're walking. And
There you go.
Right.
Absolutely.
So tell me a little bit about yourself and about how you sort of got into this 1031 business. Then we'll get into some fundamentals and then get into some advanced stuff.
Okay. Well, I'll be quite honest. I fell into this industry by accident. Truth be told, I went to school for psychology with the intention of becoming a criminal profiler.
Okay.
So when I realized that it wasn't exactly what I was looking to do, I shifted gears and I started in the 1031 industry in 2006. After a brief stint working at a real estate and mortgage office, I was looking for a change. I saw an ad in the paper. Hopefully people remember what that was like, looking for jobs in the actual newspaper.
Yeah.
And I stumbled across a role that was available working in a 1031 exchange office. I had no idea what it was. I probably had no business applying for that job, but the owners at the time took a chance on me, and they taught me the business. They taught me the industry. Been with that company, which is now Equity 1031 Exchange, ever since. And the rest, as they say, is history. It's a pretty cool thing to learn and understand. And the more you know, the more you realize there's so much more to learn and so many ways to creatively do things. So it's been an incredible journey, to say the least.
That's great. And Teresa is the president. She actually runs that whole division, part equity trust, and really do appreciate, you're going to appreciate her knowledge tonight. So let's sort of talk about sort of what is it? Everybody hears the word 1030 exchange. What is it? And so what's its primary purpose?
So 1031 is actually a section of the tax code, and it basically says if you sell investment or business use property, and you buy more investment or business use property of equal or greater value, you'll get to defer the taxes that would have otherwise been due, such as capital gains, depreciation recapture, and any applicable state taxes. So some would go so far as to say it's actually one of the few gifts from the tax code. I'm inclined to agree,
yeah.
but really it's for people to defer the taxes on the sale of investment or business use property, provided that they follow some rules, which I'm sure we'll probably talk about in a little bit.
We are. So what types of real estate qualify? So it was my I'm a CPA as well, but I do, you know, remember when you could exchange anything, right? And so now it's real estate. But what types of real estate actually qualify now that the tax law says only real estate qualifies? What is real estate?
So all real estate would typically be considered like-kind to all other types of real estate. What it comes down to, Scott, is its use. So what we're looking for is property that is held as investment or used in your business, and property that you're purchasing has to be held for investment, such as a rental or maybe some land, or property that will be used in your business. So any type of property could be exchanged for or with each other. So you could do commercial property, residential property, raw land, multifamily. It all qualifies as long as it's held with the appropriate purpose.
Gotcha. So I've got different real estate investors that are listening. Does this apply to everybody? Like, so let's say buy and hold. What about people that flip? What about people that wholesale? Does it apply to them?
Great question. So, unfortunately, it's usually not going to apply to people who flip or wholesalers. We're looking for people who are more the buy and hold. And the reason for that is no one's going to dispute that the people that flip are flipping what they consider to be investments, but it doesn't meet the definition of an investment property under the tax code. So it's got to be investment property, but it's got to be held for an appropriate amount of time as well. So that's that magical combo, so to speak. It's how you're treating it and how long you hold it.
All right. So what are there any property types particularly or situations that are explicitly excluded from this 1031 treatment? Is there anything?
Yes, absolutely. So primary homes are excluded, and many may already be aware of the fact that that has its own separate gain exclusion under Section 121. Second homes, true second homes, are excluded from this. We touched on the idea of properties that are flipped. Those, unfortunately, don't qualify for 1031 exchange. Anything that's not real property, too. So I get the question a lot of, could I sell my property and reinvest into notes, for example, that are going to loan, you know, for real estate transactions? I see where people are going with that. Unfortunately, notes are not considered real property. So you wouldn't be able to take the funds from the sale of your old property and reinvest them into something like a note.
And I think it's true, too, that if I wanted to buy a Airbnb in the Bahamas, that doesn't work either. Nothing foreign, correct?
Yes. Thank you. So it's U.S. property for U.S. property. Now, there's some instances where you could do some foreign property for foreign property. That gets a little bit more complicated.
Okay.
But you couldn't do U.S. to the Bahamas.
Great.
You're absolutely right.
All right, Teresa, we're going to take a break here in a minute. Just remember the number to call in, 877-772-9658, and we'll be back after this. All right, welcome back to Real Life Real Estate Investing. I'm Scott Ells with your host. I'm here with Teresa Noer, who is an expert with 1031 exchanges. I want to real quick mention tonight, 7:30 to 9, there's a free investor help night. You can go to CincinnatiRIA.com, register, and you'll get a link to get on that Zoom call. And the other thing is this Saturday on 7/26, starting at 9 Eastern time, there is a online masterclass that RIA is putting on. How and why to do wrap loans. That'll be a great session. You don't want to miss that. Go to CincinnatiRIA.com to sign up. So, Teresa, let's talk a little bit about the process. I guess the idea of an exchange, how does it happen? I mean, if I've got a property and you have a property, can we exchange? Is that tax-free? And if what if you and I don't have a property that we want to swap and I want to, you know, sell mine to Joe and I'm going to buy Susan. So can you just sort of walk me through the process of doing this 1031? Because I think this is a great strategy for a lot of investors.
Sure. So, yeah, we typically don't see people swapping properties with each other as often as we do the latter scenario that you described. Funny enough, that's how exchanges came to be, was two taxpayers were swapping properties with each other, and it evolved into what we see more commonly today, where you sell your old property to one person and you buy your new property from a completely separate party. Now, that process would start once you're under contract to sell your current property. That's when you want to engage the services of what's known as a qualified intermediary, or QI, as they're often referred to. The primary function of the QI is to make sure that your exchange is documented properly from start to finish. They're going to escrow those proceeds from the sale of your current property and apply them towards the purchase of the new property. And they're going to make sure that you as the taxpayer understand what the deadlines are that are involved and what you need to do to make sure that your exchange is good and kind of checks all the boxes. So anyone can reach out to a QI and talk about the process or what they need to be aware of in terms of the deadlines and the rules, but the best time, or the time where a QI could actually begin the process of setting up the exchange for you, is when you're under contract to sell your old property.
Okay.
So that'll give time to get the necessary docs together and closing instructions for whoever's handling the closing for your sale.
So you mean I can't like come to the intermediary on Wednesday, I'm closing on Friday, and you can get it done, right?
Absolutely. Yes.
What?
So
you
if you can, you can, it's not ideal, Scott, but as long as you don't close on that transaction, if everyone listening remembers nothing else, remember this: engage a QI before you close on your sale. Even if you're at the closing table, we have that happen to you sometimes, where someone will just inadvertently neglect to hire a QI, and we have a closing agent reaching out saying, hey, we need help. This client thought they had an exchange set up, or they didn't realize what they needed to do. Can you help them? Yes. Once you leave that closing table, the opportunity to do the exchange is lost. So just make sure you engage a QI before the completion of the closing.
Okay. Maybe you shouldn't give that leeway to a lot of our real estate listeners, because I literally do. Now, I historically have said, hey, I think you're going to be out of luck. So you're very gracious, and I'll make sure they call you. But I think we need to make it very clear: engage the intermediary at the time of when you're going to either, I guess, have it under contract. You need to do it then. Don't wait till the ninth hour.
Yes.
Because I guarantee that seller sitting at that table is not going to be real happy if this is delayed.
True. And you know, there's also part of the process, too, is your QI is going to ask you some questions, and they're going to want to understand, what's your plan? What are you looking to do? You know, what are you looking to purchase? What's your long-term goal? There are things that need to be discussed, and sometimes there are things that pop up that we need to we get someone like you, Scott, involved to render an opinion on before the exchange moves forward. And if somebody's doing this in the 11th hour, it's not really feasible. It's not ideal. We don't want someone rushing into this decision either. So,
okay,
yes,
well,
while it can be done last minute, it's not ideal. Your QI will be a whole lot friendlier if you plan ahead, too. I'll say that.
Yeah, I bet they will. Hey, so talk. Let's talk deadlines. So,
okay,
what are sort of the key deadlines? What happens if you miss a deadline? Is there some sort of grace period? So let's just talk about those deadlines of what needs to be done by when.
Sure. So you have two deadlines. The first is that you have 180 days from closing on your sale to complete your exchange and close on all intended purchases. It's 180 calendar days. Within the first 45 days of that 180-day period, you will have to formally identify what your target replacement properties are, or those new properties that you're going to be purchasing. Only what's identified by day 45 will qualify for the exchange. So if you miss a deadline, unfortunately, there's no way to extend that. If for some reason you forgot that your deadline to identify had passed and you call your QI and it's day 46 and say, oh my gosh, I'm so sorry, I just completely flipped my mind, can I send you the list now? Unfortunately, no. Those deadlines are hard and fast, and even if that deadline falls on a Saturday, a Sunday, or a holiday, it is still the deadline that you must adhere to. The only time that there will be an extension given is in a situation of a natural disaster, and the guidelines will be issued for that as to who would qualify and what those extensions are. So if someone just randomly misses their identification deadline or their 180th day deadline, there's no remedy for that, or you can't. Someone had asked before, can I just call the IRS and explain and get an extension? No, I wish there was, but unfortunately, no. You're pretty much out of luck if you miss either of those deadlines.
Good. Let's talk this 45-day thing, this idea of selecting my properties. So what I want to do, Teresa, is I want to come to you. And do you remember, I don't know what your age is, and you're never supposed to ask a lady that, but do you remember the old days you used to go to buy real estate? You'd walk into a real estate broker, and you would look at an MLS book. There was a book of all the properties in the area. So can I bring that book to you and say, I want to buy one of these properties? Can I do that?
Well, no. Great question. No. So there are some rules when it comes to identifying your property. The easiest one to adhere to with, I think, the least amount of restriction is, in some ways, is known as a three property rule. It says you can identify up to three properties, any value whatsoever, and you're done. You buy one of those properties, one, two, or all three if you want, but that's it. There's no restriction on the value. If someone's looking to buy more than three properties, if they want to identify more than three properties because they want to have more options, they can do that, but now there's a restriction placed on the total value that is identified, and that's known as the 200% rule. And it says you can identify four or more properties, however many you want, as long as they don't add up to more than 200% of the relinquished property value. In other words, if you sold your property for $500,000, and you want to identify 20 properties, you can do that, but they can't add up to more than $1 million worth of real estate that you're identifying. Okay. Now, those are the two main ones. There is a third one where I've only, in my almost 20 years in doing this, I've had one client do this, and they took advantage of the what's known as the 95% rule. And that is where you identify more than three properties and it exceeds that 200% threshold. That 95% rule says your exchange is still okay, but you have to acquire 95% of the identified value for your exchange to be protected and secure. I would never suggest that.
Right.
Unless all the properties are part of, one bulk purchase somehow, I definitely save yourself some stress. Stick with either the three property or the 200% rule.
That sounds like a good plan. All right, we are going to take a break. I just want to let everybody know, again, call 877-772-9658 or email vinaradio@gmail.com. And we're going to come back and we're going to talk about cash. All right, welcome back. We are here with Teresa Noer. She is a 1031 exchange expert with Equity 1031 Exchange. Again, questions, 877-772-9758 or vinaradio@gmail.com. So, Teresa, what I want to do is sort of, I'm going to throw out some things that people always try to do or questions they have, see if they can do it. So the first thing, I will say is that somebody wants exchange, but they want to get some cash. They want cash out. And I understand exchange. You can explain the issue of cash. And then if you could explain if there are some ways to get it out, either before the exchange or after the exchange. So why don't you talk a little bit about cash involved with the exchange?
Sure. So if the objective is a fully tax-deferred transaction, then I'm afraid all the cash from that sale is going to have to roll into the exchange and be applied towards the new replacement property purchase. Anything that's taken out is going to be subject to tax liability. Doesn't mean you can't do it. So if somebody understands that there will be tax implications for any cash taken out, ideally, they'd want to let their QI know before closing on the sale, hey, I want to take, you know, $10,000, $20,000, $30,000 out, whatever, however much they want to take. Let your QI know before the closing of the sale so that you can get that money at closing and the balance comes to your QI to be held in escrow for the exchange.
Okay.
Once those funds come to the QI, let's say you don't think about it and you're kind of like, oh, you know, I should have, but I didn't. Once the funds are with the QI, you won't be able to access any funds until after your exchange is completed or until perhaps you miss a deadline that, you know, maybe you don't identify properties by that 45th day. Then if that happens, your exchange is canceled and funds are returned to you. So once the funds are with the QI, you don't get to call them up and say, hey, I meant to take $10,000 out. I want to take those funds out.
Okay.
Now, as I mentioned, that's subject to tax liability if you take funds out. Another way that you could possibly do this is do the exchange and then do a refinance on the replacement property once the exchange has been completed. You hear people say sometimes, you know, it should be old and cold. I've heard people advise clients just wait at least a few months before starting that process. Definitely do not start the process of the refi while the exchange is in play, or immediately after the exchange. You kind of want to let the dust settle and then you could do that. But then you're not taking taxable boot. You're taking equity out of the property instead. Some have asked, can I do that on the relinquished property before closing? That way I can get it out then. There's mixed opinions on that. The more favorable approach would be to do the exchange and do the refi on the replacement property versus doing it on the relinquished. Not saying you can't do it, but it tends to be a little more scrutinized when it's done on the relinquished property versus when it's done on the replacement property.
Well, there's no particular,
so you can definitely get cash.
But there's no particular statute that says you can't refinance within 90 days of selling it. You could do it at any point. But I will say that from a bank standpoint, they're usually not real thrilled if you refinance 60 days and then in 60 days you sell it. There's a lot of there can be one bank here in town. Typically, there's an early payment penalty, so you got to be careful. So I agree with you. I think the post exchange is the best way to go. So, the next thing is, so you already talked about the fact that we can exchange, like I can sell five properties and buy one big one. I could sell five and buy 10. I could sell one and buy 30. My wife always wanted me to sell the apartment complex and then buy 30 single families. And I'm like, I don't think in this market that's going to work real well. But, so she does that. So we know that. What about if I've got a 1031 and I'm selling my property? A lot of people want to go in. So like I'm going to sell my property, I'm going to do a 1031, but I'm going to go and be a part owner. I'm going to invest in a partnership with this new property. It meets all the criteria. I'm putting in more money or it's a bigger property, but I'm going to do it through a partnership because I want some other folks in there with me. Can I do that?
It depends on how you structure that purchase. So short answer, yes. You don't have to be the only one buying the new replacement property. You could buy something more expensive and be a partial owner in it. But what you don't want to do is form an entity such as an LLC or some sort of formal partnership, because then you are effectively changing the taxpayer completing the exchange. Gotcha. So you'd want to purchase the replacement property, at least your interest, as a tenant in common with whoever else is going to be buying that property, ideally. Because whoever sells the relinquished property, whoever's on the deed to that old property, is the taxpayer completing the exchange. And that taxpayer needs to be the one going on the deed for their interest in the new property. So unfortunately, a lot of times people ask that question, hey, I have a friend or I know some people, we want to pool funds together, form an LLC to buy this new property. I get the reasoning why they want to do it, but it unfortunately does not work for the 1031 exchange.
You can't swap into a partnership.
Correct.
Essentially. Good. So let's so here's an example. So actually a real example of mine, we were buying a commercial property. It was owned by a partnership. And they wanted to do a 1031, but one partner didn't want to do a 1031. The other one did. So what they came to me and asked, which I'm a CPA, so I was more than willing to help them. They actually took the asset, the building, they retitled it to half, each owned 50%. One guy did a 1031 exchange. And the other one did not, and all we had to do was do an addendum to the contract that said, I was normally going to buy it from XYZ LLC, now I'm going to buy it from Jim and Joe, and then the one did it. So is that kind of a way to do that if you're in a partnership, you're going to sell something and not everybody wants to do it?
Yes. So the thing that I would encourage people to do is, again, don't wait till the last minute to do something like that, because the terminology, as I'm sure you're familiar, Scott, is a drop and swap.
Yeah.
You drop it out of the entity into the individual owners.
Yep.
If they can, do it as far in advance as
sure.
you possibly can. But that is a strategy that could be deployed so that it kind of takes away that pressure of, oh my gosh, the partnership is the one selling, so the partnership needs to buy, but not all partners. Inevitably, where one partner wants out and doesn't want to participate. So, yes, plan ahead, do the drop out of the entity so that each individual owner can decide what they want to do with their share of the sale.
How about I'm going to sell my apartment building to my brother who wants to get into real estate? And then I'm going to buy some other property. Can I do a 1031 with my brother who's a related party?
So you can sell to a related party, provided you're treating them like you would anyone else. You're going to sell it at fair market value. You just could not purchase from a related party unless that party is also doing their own 1031 exchange. So the related party rules are a little funky with 1031 exchanges, but technically you could sell to a related party and buy your replacement property from a completely unrelated third party.
So what if I sell to my brother and then 6 months later he sells it? What happens?
So there is a special rule that if you're dealing with related parties, there's a two-year holding requirement on the part of the related parties. So he really shouldn't, he should plan to hold that property for 2 years before selling that.
Otherwise, I've got to basically, my 1031 goes away and now I'm taxed on everything.
Yes. So make sure you have a good relationship with that brother for at least 2 years so he doesn't take his revenge on you and sell it early, because then your exchange is blown.
Right. Okay. So here's another one. So I'm just throwing these things out. And I do have a question from Catherine. I'll get to that in a second. We're going to get to that. But so let's say that I read a court case on this, so I'm just trying to get your opinion on it. I think it's important. So let's say I do a 1031. I sell the single family house for $400, and I buy a property up on the lake. On Lake Erie, and I'm going to make it an Airbnb, or I'm going to just make it a long-term rental. But I literally I can't get it rented. I try and try and try. So I'm legitimately, I mean, there is a real, my goal really was not to live in it. But let's say I just cannot get it rented, and then I go and move into it. What happens then?
So I think I would have a couple questions. One would be, when exactly did you move into it? Was it what in what time frame? Because technically, if after 2 years of holding the property, you could take the steps to making it your primary residence. So I would, if somebody came to me with that, I'd say, well, how long have you been trying to rent it out? How, you know, what have you been doing with it? If they said, oh, it's been 2 years, that's, to me, I think if you make a concerted effort to rent it out and just no one's biting and you can demonstrate and show evidence of that, I my opinion, which means nothing, okay, I'm not with the IRS or anything, right, but I feel that if you can make the case that you really did try, you just couldn't, and circumstances dictated that you move into it, I don't know how you could be penalized for that.
Yeah,
but I think you'd have to have some good documentation. I think you would have to really show, I would really say, if you can show there was zero personal use during the time that you were trying to rent it out, that would certainly, right, you know, bolster the case even more.
Right.
But you can't, life happens, you know, and it can't always be black and white. But I think it'll just come down to, was your intent with the property clear? And that to me should be sufficient. If you can prove that your intent was to rent it out, but it just didn't work out,
right,
I can't see a taxpayer getting penalized for that.
No,
that's my opinion.
Yeah, and I did see a case where the taxpayer proved that they made a good effort and they moved into it within 9 months of buying it, but they just couldn't get it rented out, and the court agreed, and the IRS lost. So I think there's some stuff in there. So one question we had before we go on break. To do the 1031 exchange, this is from Catherine, do you have to use a QI, qualified intermediary? And if you do, how much do they charge? In other words, can I just use Uncle Harry to be my QI?
Good question. Yes, you do. I mean, unless you're literally, there are rare instances where you don't need a QI, like where if you're truly just swapping deeds with someone else, which rarely happens, there's usually some cash involved. So you do need a QI. It does have to be an unrelated third party that facilitates the exchange for you. You cannot use a related party. You cannot act as your own QI, and you can't use anyone who is in an existing relationship with you, such as your CPA or your attorney. Sometimes they have affiliated businesses where they offer QI services. The only way that you'd be able to use that CPA or attorney is if you haven't had an ongoing or existing relationship with them for the last 2 years.
Great.
So no, Uncle Harry or whoever that was could not facilitate your exchange.
So real quick before we go on break, so what's a typical charge for a normal 1031? I know there's lots of special ones, but what is a normal 1031? What does that cost you?
A normal 1031 exchange is going to cost you somewhere around $1,200.
Okay.
Roughly, give or take.
Super. All right. We are just, we're going to take a break. 877-772-9658, and we will be back. Welcome back. I just want to remind everybody that tonight there's a free investor help night. Go to CincinnatiRIA.com, and you can sign up. Starts 7:30 tonight. It's a great time. It's free. No charge. You really can get some good questions answered. And then Saturday, there's an online masterclass. Starts at 9 a.m. Eastern. Go to CincinnatiRIA.com to sign up for that. These are great sessions, very inexpensive, that RIA puts on. It's good. So, all right. So we are here with Teresa Noer. She is an expert with 1031s. And we're just talking about the stuff that's sort of a little bit on the, I wouldn't say crazy, but just sort of out of the ordinary. So the one thing I would ask is, then there was a question off the air, and we answered one of them, which was cash out. And then there was a question about estate plan. And I will say that from an estate standpoint, you know, the idea of exchanges is I buy the thing for $500, I depreciate it, and I then sell it maybe 5 years down the road. I buy something bigger, and then I keep doing that and doing it and doing it. As long as the tax law doesn't change, where they take away 1031s, which then puts, I guess, Teresa out of business. She has to find a different job. but assuming that doesn't happen, which I don't think they will, because there's too many people in Congress who also have real estate who don't want that to be eliminated. So I think it'll mm-hmm. stay around. But what happens is you still have it, and then if you what I tell you is the way to win is to die. Now you don't really win. Your heirs win. But you die, and their heirs get a step up in basis. So if I've 1031, I start with a $100,000 property, and I'm eventually at like a $2 million property, and I'm depreciated it almost fully with the deferral of the gain and that kind of thing. And so if I were to sell it the day before I die, I'm going to pay tax on, just call it $2 million even. I'm going to pay tax on that $2 million. Maybe some land is still there, but I'm going to pay tax on that. And if I just keep it for one more day and my wife inherits it or my kids inherit it, they get it at a value that is the $2 million. They can sell it and pay no tax. Remember, I give it away before I die, or I sell, let's put it this way. Let's say I sell it before I die. I'm going to pay tax on the whole $2 million. That's a lot of tax. But if I can just keep it until I die, again, I guess I'm dead. I'm not really winning. But my heirs are. They're going to get that $2 million in cash sitting on the table, and Uncle Sam is not going to come in and grab $1. And that is what makes this 1031 exchange so powerful as you're building your real estate portfolio. But let's talk a little bit about, depreciation recapture, because that's the problem with depreciation with rental property, buy and hold stuff, is that, think about it. Does real estate really depreciate? It doesn't. But the IRS says you can deduct it over a residential over 27 and a half years. But at the end of that period of time, you depreciated it. And the problem with selling it is the IRS wants the tax on all that depreciation you took, because it really didn't depreciate. Now they knew it, but we have to then pick up and pay tax on all that depreciation that we got to deduct. So let's talk about depreciation recapture. What happens with that in the exchange? I know the capital gain is fully deferred. What happens with that depreciation that is in there?
That is also deferred through the 1031 exchange.
That is awesome. Now, what if a lot of people do cost segs? So let's say that they defer $400,000 in gain, and this might be beyond your scope, but I'm trying to explain to people how it sort of works. If I've deferred $400,000 in gain, what does that do to the basis of my new property?
So I'm going to put it in very simple terms, and Scott, I'm going to ask you to add whatever color you want to it, but basically it reduces the basis of the replacement property by the gain deferred. So if you're deferring $400,000 in gain, the basis of the replacement property, if you buy something, say, for $1 million, the basis is now going to be $600,000 because it's factoring in that $400,000 in gain that's been deferred through the exchange.
Right. So people need to understand that. I can still do a cost segregation for the new property, but my problem is that my basis is now only 600. So it's getting down. I had one client who they'd done a cost seg, but over the period of time it had gotten so low that the new property, even though it was $600,000 purchase, they had deferred so many gains that it was really only had a basis of 100, and that became very hard to do any kind of cost segregation that they would do. So I think that's one thing that is important. Let's talk a little bit about is there any kind of legislation you see on the horizon that could impact 1031s? Or yeah, so let's start with that.
Nothing. I mean, you know, there's always rumblings about trying to restrict things. In the past, there was always rumblings about that, or trying to limit the amount of gain that could be deferred in an exchange per tax year. But no, nothing, knock on wood, nothing that is of any major concern or minor concern.
How about everybody now, the IRS has gotten somewhat of a cut. They got a big increase, and they got a little bit of a cut. So what the question is, do you see a lot of audits? And I know you don't necessarily work in audit, but do you think it's an item? If you do a 1031, is that sort of a flag or anything like that, that somebody's going to come in and look? Do you see that stuff getting audited?
So only speaking from personal experience, I have, knock on wood, I have yet to have a client contact us to say, I'm being audited, because I would imagine we'd be the first call or one of the first calls that they would make saying, I'm being audited, I need copies of my docs, I need something, I need help. So, no, I don't really think that's, I've been told, okay, these are not really the priority in terms of audits, especially if we're talking about transactions that are, in their eyes, smaller, such as, sure, you know, the single family rental that's been exchanged. I think what they're looking more closely at are those bigger ticket items, those bigger ticket exchanges, multi-million dollars, or if you've got partnerships involved, sometimes that could be a potential flag, yeah, because they do want to keep an eye on things that could be poorly planned drop and swaps or things like that, or related party transactions, because that is specifically something that, you know, has such type restrictions.
Sure. Right.
But no, I don't, okay, see that. I think they've got a lot going on, and thankfully, sure, 1031s are not really the focal point, unless,
gotcha,
again, it's something that really catches their attention in terms of just big dollars, big transactions, I should say, big exchanges.
So let's jump. The last thing I want to talk about tonight, we could talk for another hour about all the crazy things you can do with exchanges. But one that is typical, it's not that crazy. It's in this market, if I put my property on for sale, mm-hmm, and I sell it, to select that 45 days, I got to select property and I have to close on one of those properties. And it is, mm-hmm, very hard when property goes so fast. I may not get it. I mean, unless I have it under contract already, I mean, there's a good chance I'm not going to buy anything. So some, mm-hmm, people want to do a reverse. They want to buy it. So you got about 2 minutes. If you can, mm-hmm, summarize what a reverse exchange, mm-hmm, looks like, where you buy it first and then sell it, and sort of what's involved. I know that's not much time to tell about it.
I'll do my best. So, yeah, that's basically what a reverse is. It allows you to buy first, then sell within the same 180-day period now, but it's a little bit more involved in terms of how this is handled. So what the QI is going to do basically is step in as a temporary title holder for that new property, and they're basically going to hold it for you. You're going to provide the funding for it, but the QI is going to form an entity that will take title to that replacement property and hold it for you while you try to find a buyer for your old relinquished property. And the reason why it's done that way is you cannot take title to the new replacement property because you haven't yet sold your old property. And if you're on title to both, or you're on the deed to both, you own both at the same time, there is no exchange taking place at any point in time. So you need that temporary title holder stepping in and basically, okay, parking that property for you. And that reverse exchange is basically buying you 180 days to sell your old property and still take advantage of that tax deferral.
You did awesome in that time to explain that. So if someone wants to explore their first exchange, I would recommend that they reach out to a 1031 QI, see if you can even buy some of their time to just talk about some specifics, make sure you know what you're doing. Mm-hmm. Teresa, I want to thank you so much for being with us tonight. Your knowledge that you brought tonight is truly going to help out our audience in their investing empire that they, aww, are building.
Well,
so I really,
you,
really appreciate it. Thanks for being on. And for those listening, thanks for being here. And we'll see everyone next week.